From the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA, it's Sunday House Call with Dr. Barry Dworkin. If you have a medical question, call us at 521-TALK. That's 521-8255. Email sundayhousecall@cfra.com. Now here's Dr. Barry Dworkin.
Good afternoon and welcome to edition number 407 for this July 29th, 2012. Living the healthcare myth, alas, not the dream. Taking your calls at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 are the numbers to call. And we'll be getting to your calls a little bit later on, and probably by about 4:30. And as I said, we have a guest coming on in literally a few seconds, and I think you're going to find this very interesting, and hence living the healthcare myth, alas, not the dream.
You're unbelievable. You're so unbelievable.
When you get together with friends from another country, how would you describe our healthcare system? Do you really know what it's all about? An article is making the rounds in newspapers around the country that outlines the myths and misconceptions about our healthcare system. It provides additional information to use in our discussion about the future of our system in the face of consistent and escalating healthcare costs. Stephen Skivington is president of the public relations firm Polytrain, and from 1995 to 2001, he was the manager of government relations for the Ontario Medical Association, and during that time as well, he ran the OMA Political Action Committee. For the purposes of disclosure, I have worked with Mr. Skivington when he was a consultant for the Coalition of Family Physicians when I was a member of the board. I'm no longer on the board, having resigned from the board of the Coalition of Family Physicians several years ago. Good afternoon, Steve.
Hello, Barry. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. And I read your article, and needless to say, I have to admit my biases, and I agreed with what you wrote. But I wanted to bring you on the air and ask you to sort of talk about this in a bit more detail. And my first question is, why did you write the article?
Well, it's funny. I had a problem where I was on the waiting list for 14 months waiting for heart surgery. Mm-hmm. And people thought it was because of that. But I've actually been writing this article in my head for about 10 years now, and I finally set it down about 2 or 3 weeks ago. These are sort of my observations of our healthcare system. I've been really blessed. I've been able to work with some of the best doctors, nurses, pharmacists through my work, both with the OMA and on my own with Polytrain. And mm-hmm. I thought it was time that this debate happened. One of my great concerns is that there seems to be a great deal of hysteria whenever we have this kind of discussion. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, some people have accused me of being cynical who've read the article, and I certainly didn't think I was being cynical when I wrote it. I was trying to be truthful, but mm-hmm. I think it's so rare that we have truth injected into this discussion that perhaps it comes across sounding cynical, but that certainly wasn't my intention.
Well, and that leads me to the question of, in your experience in dealing with and discussing health issues with politicians and healthcare providers and various groups on either side of the issue, what do they believe about our healthcare system, and do they subscribe to some of the myths that you discuss in this article? You know, when you talk about what's going on now with the Ontario government and their latest decisions and potential changes to healthcare with regards to physician fees and other initiatives, what do you think is going on here?
Well, there's the public discussion and the private discussion, and of course, having being a registered lobbyist, I've been very very fortunate to be in back rooms and have real discussions with people and real discussions with politicians about how they really feel about this stuff. And, I'll give an example here.
Sure.
This is an example of how crazy this is. The Leafs goaltender, a former goaltender, he's gone on to Detroit now, Jonas Gustafsson, had 3 ablations for atrial fibrillation, which is what I was also suffering from. Mm-hmm. He had 3 of them in the 14 months that I was on the waiting list, waiting to have my one. And, you know, the lunacy of that, I mean, God bless him. I could see why the Leafs would want him back into the net in a hurry. But
right.
The lunacy of that really speaks a great deal to our system. And, you know, one of the things I talk about is we had a phrase back when I was at the OMA in the late 90s, which was fund it or free it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, clearly I think the impasse right now between the Ontario Medical Association and the Ontario government is all about funding it or freeing it. And, you know, in an odd sort of way, government is kind of admitting they can't afford to fund the healthcare system. So perhaps this will be a major catalyst in getting that that mature debate, which mm-hmm. we keep talking about we need to have. Maybe that will help us get there and have that mature debate in public.
So as you mentioned, in your private discussions with politicians and people who are in a position to set policy, have they admitted to you that indeed the system, as you know, as it stands now, just cannot continue as it is?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, I mean, they'll be frank and admit it. And then, unfortunately, spin doctors, people in my profession, you know, have sold the politicians on the myth that you can't go down this road. You'll lose the election. I believe the very opposite. I think that the Zoomers and Boomers are way ahead of the politicians on this one. They have to stand up and be counted. And frankly, I think if there's a politician out there who comes forward and actually, you know, is honest
mm-hmm.
and says what they really believe and that it's time that we did have a parallel private system, I think that person would win an election by landslide, frankly. I absolutely think the people are way ahead of the politicians on this one, especially judging by the emails I'm getting from the article.
Is there any evidence, you know, aside from the emails, any other evidence poll-wise or, you know, well-conducted polls, I guess, to look and see what the public's view is on this?
Well, I know when we did that event with the coalition back about, about 6 years ago,
mm-hmm.
we had a poll done by Greg Lyle's group, Innovative Research, who does the polling for Maclean's magazine, so they're certainly not a rinky-dink outfit. They're a first-class operation. And we got that onto the front page of the National Post. 51% of Canadians were open at that time, six years ago,
mm-hmm.
to having a parallel private healthcare system. I'm sure that number is much higher now. I have no doubt that it is. And, you know, the reality is, if we don't do something now, this is like the Titanic's heading mm-hmm. for the iceberg here. If we don't do something now, then by the year 2025, you know, I hope you like roll toads, and I hope you like private schools, and I hope you like your police being private, because if you're going to have publicly funded health care, it's going to take up 100% of the budget, and everything else is going to have to be privatized. So really, it's time to stop being silly and have a mature mm-hmm. discussion now and actually do something about this before it's too late.
Well, what we're going to do is we're going to take a small break, and when we come back, we're going to discuss five of the myths that were in the article. And I'm sure, Steve, that there are other myths as well, but the article only gave you a certain amount of space. So if there's other ones other than those five, I'd like to discuss those as well. But I think our listeners are going to find this very interesting to hear what these myths are, because these are what people are told over and over again. And you essentially take them to task and show the evidence why this is not the case. So we're going to take a small break for the weather and a few of our sponsors. And then we'll come back. We're in discussion with Stephen Skivington, president of public relations firm Polytrain, about his article about myths of our healthcare system. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call, and we'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA.
I'm about to lose my mind. You've been gone for so long. I'm running out of time. I need a
580 CFRA's Sunday House Call. Your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
Welcome back. We'll be taking your calls just after 4:30. Right now, we are in conversation with Stephen Skivington, president of the public relations firm Polytrain. He was manager of the government relations for the Ontario Medical Association between 1995 and 2001, and has had extensive experience in dealing with government on all levels, especially in the healthcare field, and has been privy to some of the discussions that really don't make it into the public realm. And Steve, I wanted to let me bring you back on here. Steve, I wanted to start off with the myths that you talk about in your article that you've written.
Yep.
And the first one is Canada has a healthcare system.
Yep. And what I say in the article, of course, is we don't have a healthcare system. We have an insurance scheme and a badly run one at that. You know, one of the things you have to understand is that our system in Ontario, which is pretty much similar all across the country, Ontario's OHIP, is really all about rationing health care. And unlike the states where you're rationed by the size of your bank account or your credit card, here it's rationed by waiting times. And, you know, I can prove we don't have a system because mm-hmm. we don't measure quality and we don't measure results. So I waited for 14 months for my heart surgery. Had I died on the waiting list, which I almost did, mm-hmm. That would have almost been seen as a good thing because it would have meant that the line moved a little quicker and that there was one less person on the line, so the next guy could move up and get his surgery even quicker. So that when they look at this, they're not measuring whether I had a happy outcome, I got back to work, I died, whatever it is. They're simply measuring, you know, how fast did the line move. That's not a healthcare system. And, you know, again, to add to the lunacy of this, we saw, I guess, in the last week, the woman who went to Buffalo for an MRI.
Right.
It actually showed she'd had a stroke. She got in there about 3 months earlier than she would have otherwise and saved her life in Canada. And now they won't pay for her MRI, OHIP. I guarantee you OHIP spent more on the lawyers to deny her the payment back of the MRI than what the MRI cost. And, you know, this is just nuts. We see that poor little boy who's going blind. There's mm-hmm. there's just example after example after example where clearly this is an insurance scheme. This is not a healthcare system.
So when we hear about outcomes, is this primarily from outside sources? Do we have real data? Do we have information that can give us a good glimpse of how our healthcare system operates?
Well, I don't know, but I kind of doubt it because when you remember this, when we had this big, a wait list initiative a few years ago when all that money was poured in by the feds, and this was going to, Paul Martin, this was going to change healthcare for a generation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what we ended up with was a website telling us how long we're going to be waiting, and as the Chihuly decision made quite clear, a website, waiting for healthcare and finding out about it on a website is not the same as actually getting healthcare and getting the service, so... You know, you've got to get rid of that first misconception that we actually have a system.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I would argue that if it wasn't for the good work by you guys, the docs, the nurses, the pharmacists, this so-called system would have collapsed under its own weight a long time ago. And in a way, it's a shame you guys have done such a phenomenal job holding it together because we probably could have had this discussion 5 or 10 mm-hmm. years ago instead of almost being on the verge of having it now.
Your second myth is that healthcare in Canada is free.
Oh, yeah, we used to have another funny expression at the OMA, if it's free, it's for me. it's not free. It's very expensive. And I think people have to understand this. And part of the problem is, I believe we used to call the docs used to call it, the emergency room docs used to call it the $500 lunch.
Mm-hmm.
When you go into the emergency room, which so many people do and they don't need to, when you go in for something, it's going to cost $500. Whereas if you went to see your family doctor the next day, it would be the, I can't remember what the fee is, 20 something?
$33.
$33 now. Things have improved so dramatically. there's the $500 lunch, people going to emerge who shouldn't. But there's other problems too. What happens is, the bean counters, the bureaucrats start playing games. So there's what we call the 75% HIP. And the 75% HIP is when we had this big waitlist strategy on about, I believe, 5 areas, one of which was hip replacements. And so the idea was we can do so many hip replacements with the best hip. But if we get the hip that costs 75%, we can do even more, and it'll look even better, and the lines will go even quicker. Mm-hmm. Well, what's happened is the 75% hip didn't work out so well, and now a lot of people are having to go back and get that hip replaced with the better hip, which is not only costing us money, but when you think of the pain and suffering, sure, there's few things more painful than a hip replacement, you know, when you're up into your 50s, 60s, 70s. So this is not free. You don't get a bill. You don't get a monthly bill, so maybe you don't realize it, but our healthcare system is not free in any way, shape, or form.
And I would, there's, I think, was it 30% is private anyway in Canada,
yeah,
with dental care, physiotherapy, prescriptions. You have government, public service employees have healthcare plans that others don't have.
Yep.
So I'd imagine that, you know, you don't have a universal system per se. You have a mixture of public and private already.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And by the way, to prove it's not a system, mm-hmm, if it really was a healthcare system, dental would be covered because dental causes many, many,
sure,
many healthcare problems. And I would even argue drugs would be, mm-hmm, be covered. I mean, how nuts that you can't afford the drugs that are going to keep you alive. You know, this truly is not a system.
Well, the other argument that follows, which is the third myth, is that we only have one tier of health in Canada, healthcare in Canada.
Yep.
And what have you seen in your in your discussions with people and your observations?
Well, you know, we talk about the many different tiers. There's both legal and illegal. We got the tier for the injured workers in Ontario. That's the WSIB.
Mm-hmm.
There's a tier for military personnel. There's a tier for high-ranking executives with private health plans. As I mentioned, we already have the professional athletes tier.
Right.
Unfortunately, I couldn't get in on. there's the doctor tier, the friends of doctors, and yes, even politicians. You know, all those different tiers. And then, you know, I talk about medical tourism tier, the animals getting MRI tier, and so on and so on. I mean, it's nuts to suggest that we are one tier and that two tier would somehow be bad. I mean, boy, two-tier would be great compared to the 10 or 12 tiers we have now.
So what do you mean by animals getting MRIs?
Well, they stopped this. I believe they stopped it. Now, it's still possible that it's happening, but there were dogs and cats were getting MRIs after hours at nights and weekends. I think it was down in the southwestern Ontario in the 90s, when I was late 90s, mm-hmm, when I was at the OMA, that they had the capacity to do this. They weren't running it on humans. They were doing it on animals. It was quite nuts.
So the other myth that you have is if you're in favor of private health care, you're not a true patriotic Canadian.
I know, and you know, I can understand hockey and patriotism being linked, but you know, Medicare, how on earth did that happen? I just find this whole business that anyone who's in favor of a private system, like our good friend Dr. Brian Day, is somehow not a Canadian or less of a Canadian or not patriotic. And, you know, one of the things that drives me nuts is that politicians love to say during election time that our health care system is what defines us as Canadians. And I certainly hope not, because I for one would not want to stand up with a big foam finger and shout out, we're number 30, we're number 30, mm-hmm, you know, which, you know, it's again, the phony argument that gets made over and over and over again by these people.
And the other issue is the status quo is just fine. We should just leave things as they are and let things sort of work themselves out. What is wrong with that?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the problem, where if you don't want a U.S.-style healthcare system, then we have to make some changes now and develop a made-in-Canada solution, because the best way to end up with what everyone says we don't want is simply to do nothing. And that's what I was alluding to earlier, that I've seen the healthcare budget grow to from about 25% to 50% just in about the last 10 or 15 years. It's not going to take a lot of imagination to imagine that in the next 10 to 15, it'll be getting up closer to 100% at the rate things are going. So we cannot continue to do nothing, and I'm sorry that we really wasted the last decade, you know, tinkering around the edges. The politicians are so timid. The premiers just said, well, we're going to buy a bunch of generic drugs and we'll buy them in bulk and see if that makes a difference a year from now. That's not the kind of solution. And, you know, the message I would want to leave people with is our healthcare system belongs to us, not the politicians.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important that we don't forget that. And, again, I say laughingly, If someone out there wants to make a bumper sticker, a website, or get it trending on Twitter, that Fund It or Free It, I think that Fund It or Free It is a great rallying cry for all of us to get our politicians to finally do something and make a change that will make us all happy in the end.
Well, again, what strikes me is that it's not as if you have to reinvent the wheel because, again, if we look at universal systems, so that excludes the United States, and you look at universal systems, which primarily Europe, New Zealand, Australia, other Western countries, they all have an element of a hybrid system that seems to work very well, that protects all its citizens, that that works and has better outcomes than we do. And it just seems a shame that we don't want to look at that and adopt some of those things because, again, it's not as if it's untested. These systems are in place.
Oh, absolutely. And what it comes down to is, you know, will our politicians finally have the courage to be honest with us? You know, it's time to quit, you know, playing games. It's really time for honesty before it's too late. Because as I say, that iceberg is looming out there, and the Titanic's heading right for it. So I hope to God we're not going to be sinking the ship.
Stephen Skivington is president of the public relations firm Polytrain, was manager of government relations for the Ontario Medical Association from 1995 to 2001. And Stephen, I'd like to thank you very much for taking time on this Sunday to talk about this, and I wish you all the best. I think this article will generate some discussion.
Well, thanks a lot, Barry. I appreciate having me on.
All the best. And we're going to take a small break for the news and come back with your calls. 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You are listening to Sunday House Call, back in about 3 minutes.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. Call your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall at cfra.com.
*580 on Bell Mobility, and our long distance number 1-800-580-2372. All our lines are available, so if you call now, you will definitely get on right away. And otherwise, you've got me for the next half an hour. I have a few actually interesting things to talk about, believe it or not. One of them is an interesting series of articles published just last week in the British Medical Journal. If you're about to exercise or you go out and you're working out and you're sweating and then you go for your sports drink to replenish, you may want to read the articles that are in the British Medical Journal. This was actually posted by Dr. Yoni Friedhoff last week, and it is quite an amazing series of articles. It looks at 40 years of data with regards to sports drinks in order to determine whether the studies that were done on these particular drinks were valid. And given that most of the studies were conducted by the companies that actually produce the drinks, you have to be suspect as well, just from conflict of interest points of view. And they found that many of the studies were of poor quality, and the general conclusions with regards to sports drinks are that, and some of the recommendations with regards to hydration really don't pass the muster. And in this case, the notion that you should drink before you feel thirsty, no evidence for that. Energy drinks with caffeine or other compounds improve sports performance, really nothing more than equivocal benefit from the caffeine. Carbohydrates and protein combinations improve post-workout performance and recovery, no evidence to support that. Using various branched-chain amino acids to improve performance or recovery after exercise. Again, equivocal, not much evidence to support it. So there are a lot of aspects, and this is only several of the many myths that are busted in this particular series of articles. It's seven articles written for the most part for the public to read and get a glimpse on exactly how this billion, multi-billion dollar industry has sort of wormed its way into recommendations from various sports organizations and various sports clubs through sponsorship and through just promoting this over and over and over again until it becomes a factoid. That is something that doesn't have evidence, but just is repeated often enough that people remember it and think, yeah, sort of sounds reasonable. May as well go ahead and do it. So again, it's in the British Medical Journal, series of articles. The articles are called Myth-Busting Sports and Exercise Products. There's other ones, 40 Years of Sports Performance Research and Little Insight Gained, The Role of Rehydration in Health and Exercise. So a whole bunch of stuff on, and The Truth About Sports Drinks is another one of them. So, but it's a series of seven articles that give information from all different areas. 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is the number to call. An experimental treatment that may, emphasize may, because it is not a standard treatment yet. It's simply they are looking into this. It's sort of moving forward with the idea that if you could desensitize children with food allergies, especially in this case they looked at egg allergies, it could reduce and eliminate potentially life-threatening allergic reactions in some children. And this is a research conducted in the United States. So according to the Center for Disease Control in the United States, 4% of children in the United States have food allergies. And this study appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine. What they found and what they did is they gave small but increasing doses of egg white powder for 10 months, followed by several years of maintenance dosing. And they found that more than one out of every four children who were treated with the egg white powder lost their allergic reaction altogether after 2 years. So they went from having serious allergic reactions after a single bite of an egg-containing cookie to consuming eggs with minimal or no symptoms. So quite a dramatic change. And this was conducted at Baltimore's Johns Hopkins Children's Center at the Immunology Department. But they caution that it is still highly experimental. So they and again, so if you're going to write an email at bdworkin@cfra.com and you want to ask about this particular treatment, either someone tells you about it, you have to remember it's in a research phase. It is not available anywhere yet. They still have to flesh this out. And it was a relatively small study. It was 55 children, ages 5 to 11, with egg allergies. They received either controlled doses of egg white powder or cornstarch powder, which served as the placebo. And then they followed them. Over 10 months, 22 months, and 24 months. They sort of checked them and they exposed them to these larger doses of egg white powder. And after 10 months, half of them, 55% of the children treated with the egg therapy passed the challenge. They didn't have very much of a reaction. At 22 months into the study, 75% of the children in the egg treatment group passed the food challenge. But the kicker to all of this is most lost the tolerance they had achieved after stopping the daily egg exposures. So it seems that if you were to do this right now, you would have to continue eating eggs over and over every day in order to prevent your allergy from coming back. And how realistic that is, that's to be determined. But nevertheless, very interesting in that they're trying to find other ways to reduce allergies. And again, this is just egg allergies, not other ones. And more research obviously is going to continue, but these type of things hopefully will lead to a different approach or an adjunct approach to trying to treat food allergies. We're going to go to the phone lines and go to line one and speak to Jim in Orleans. Good afternoon.
Yeah, hi, Dr. Dorquist.
Hi.
I just have a quick question about my wife bought a book there. It's called Lose the Wheat and Lose the Weight.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a prominent a newsman on some of the on one of the cable networks in the States that's extolling the virtues of
yes,
this
of
stuff.
Course.
Like he just raves about it.
Right.
What are your comments on that one?
The currency for weight loss is calorie restriction. right? There is an excellent book that's written by Timothy Caulfield. I'm about halfway through the book now. It's called The Cure for Everything. And it deals with issues regarding diet, exercise, genetics, pill pushers, alternative medicine, pharmaceutical companies, and how they push their products. I mean, it really doesn't choose sides. It just simply looks at the evidence that's out there. Right. And every diet that is out there, every diet that is promoted, frankly, will not work. And the reason it doesn't work is that diets impose restrictions that for most people, they are not prepared to live with. And unless someone is prepared to live a certain way for the rest of their life, what will happen is that they will lose weight initially, regardless of the diet that they choose. And thereafter, once the diet ends, they will gain the weight back. And that happens to 95 out of every 100 people that this happens to. And that is the evidence for it. 95 out of 100 will get their weight back within usually about a year to 2 years after their diet. People don't like to change. And so it's very difficult to, especially in our environment the way it is, to restrict calories or to change what we eat. But it does boil down to portion sizes. It boils down to keeping certain things out of the house. Exercise is a very small component, believe it or not. Exercise does not contribute very much to weight loss, despite what television may like to tell you, especially on The Biggest Loser and those type of shows.
Mm-hmm.
Exercise may account for about 10% of weight loss because we tend to overestimate the calories we expend. And being human, we reward ourselves for it.
But then the other benefits of exercising,
absolutely,
are very important also.
Well, you're absolutely correct, and that's exactly what Dr. Caulfield mentions is that you have positive benefits on reducing risk of diabetes, improved muscle mass, reduced risk of osteoporosis, your bone strength is better, your mood is better. So there are definite, by no means am I saying not to exercise, but when people say, oh, I'm going to go to the gym to lose weight, and that is their primary reason for exercising, they're going to get very disappointed.
Now, the lose the weight, lose the wheat and lose the weight, is that a diet?
If they're talking about getting rid of a particular food or a particular class of food, all they're doing is they're trying to reduce your calories. So you could say, stop the meat, lose your meat. So if you stop the, you can do all kinds of things that will result in calorie restriction. But the issue becomes, is someone willing to give up their bread rolls? Are they willing to give up the sandwiches that they're eating? Are they willing to give up the foods that they like where wheat is concerned? And sure, you may find some people that want to do that, but ultimately, most people will not want to do that for the next 50 years of their life.
I know personally, I will never be able to do that.
That's right.
Because I like my rye toast in the morning and, it's just... I would never be able to follow that. Never.
Yeah, and again, there are many factors that contribute to our people gaining weight. As we get older, our calorie requirements decrease with age. So even if we don't even change how much we eat, you will still gain weight as you get older because your body doesn't need as many calories to function.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why you tend to see people, they gain weight. Most people, as they get older, they tend to gain weight on average, if you look in just a general population viewpoint. And that's because their need for calories goes down. They may not be as active, which will contribute a little bit. But also by not being as active, they may be eating a bit more or eating things they shouldn't be. So all those things are contributing factors. Plus the fact, when people drink calorie-laden sodas or having, one too many beers or wine or any fluid calories, it does not curb your appetite. So in other words, you could drink water or you can drink a liter of Pepsi and you'll still eat the same amount. And the difference is with the water, you won't get any calories. With the Pepsi, you've just added, 200, 300, 500 extra calories a day.
Yeah.
And you're still eating the same amount. So there's a lot of things that go in with regards to our weight and weight gain. So I would, my first reaction to anybody that's on television, radio, print, whatever, who's making claims to say, do this and it's the best thing and it'll solve your problems, run away in the other direction.
Now, just before...
Sure.
It's Timothy Caulfield?
Caulfield. Timothy Caulfield.
C-A-U?
C-A-U-F-I-E-L-D.
Okay.
F-I-E-L-D.
Thank you, Doctor.
You're very welcome.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And we'll take a small break and come back with your calls. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call. Back in a couple of minutes.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
Doctor, need you back home, baby. Doctor, where you at? Give me something. I need your love, I need your love, I need your loving. You got that kind of medicine that keep me coming.
My body needs a hero, come save me. Something tells me you know how to save me. I've been feeling real low. Oh, I need you to come and rescue me.
And back to the phone lines. And a good afternoon to George in Ottawa.
Yes, good day, sir. How are you today?
I'm fine. How are you?
Oh, we're blessed with this weather, that's for sure.
No kidding. All I do, and people say, oh, you know, it's too hot. I say, I just think of January, and I don't complain at all.
Well, we got to complain to the fool on the hill, but besides that, what can we say? But I just wanted to get back. You were speaking about diet, and you're this doctor... Yanni Friehoff was on your show on this radio station last week.
Yeah.
And he was going on about putting down vitamin C.
I think you have your radio on, right?
Pardon me?
If your radio is on, you have to turn the radio off because you're getting a delayed response.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay.
Is that better?
Yeah, that's much better. So go ahead.
Okay,
you were saying he was talking about vitamin C and not too happy about it.
Well, he was putting it down, and it's so such a valuable element on this planet. And to hear him putting it down, then learning about later, listening to his advertisements on your same station for his clinic for weight loss, and then saying that he doesn't use supplements.
Right.
It kind of rang true that. His knowledge is not too great on vitamin C, obviously.
I don't think you can say that, George, and he's not here to defend himself with that. And I'm not sure if he was on the air last week talking about vitamin C. The point is, well, what is it that...
Well, maybe it was CBC that he was making a statement. Yeah, I think it was actually CBC that he made a statement. They were doing a story on vitamins, and he was one of the...
Because the evidence that is out there has stated that taking vitamin supplements, other than really vitamin D, there really isn't much evidence for taking those supplements and having the claims that are made according to what these supplements do verifiable. So,
well, I would like to inform your listeners on your station, which were promoting this stuff and promoting his company for weight loss, that has he got a Nobel Prize at all?
George, that's not a reasonable thing to be talking about. There's a lot of people who don't get Nobel Prizes who happen to know what they're talking about. So,
well, vitamin C has numerous Nobel Prizes for its use.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't
You're a doctor, are you?
Yes, I am, George.
Well, you should do some research.
All right,
Google vitamin C.
Thank you, George. Disrespect is not included on this station. So thank you very much for your call. We're going to go to Helen in Ottawa. Good afternoon, Helen.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I just had a shingles shot. I didn't go in for it, but I ended up having one. I guess I'm the right age.
Right.
And I didn't have, that was on Thursday, and I didn't have any reaction till Saturday. There was redness at the site.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not too worried about that. It's a little bit itchy and stuff.
Right.
And I had a little sore in my mouth. I just happened to notice it on Saturday. And that's kind of, seems like it's healing over.
Okay.
And I have a little, some little blisters now. And I'm just wondering, is that cause for concern.
Oh, that can happen, especially with the vaccine. But it's essentially a very mild reaction from the virus that was given as part of the vaccine.
Okay, so this is normally to be expected.
Yeah, and again, if you're not feeling overly taxed by it, and it's normal to have some, soreness in the arm, and you can definitely get redness and sometimes little blisters at the site. It's very similar.
Well, it's not at the site, though. The blisters aren't at the site.
Oh, where are they?
They're on my bum.
Okay. And it only in that area? Nowhere else?
Nowhere else that I can...
Okay.
No.
Well, it may or may not be as a result of the vaccine. I mean, usually you see the reaction at the site of where the vaccine is given. You know, very similarly with the chickenpox vaccine that are given to children. 3 to 5% will develop a rash around the site of injection, and the same percentage may get blistering around that area.
The little
vesicles that almost looks like chicken pox in that area.
Oh.
But I don't think what you're experiencing there is likely the result of that vaccine.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right, just concerned. Thank you very much.
All right, Helen. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
And just to follow up on George's comments about vitamin C, I would direct him to the website called consumerlab.com. First of all, vitamin C does not have any Nobel Prizes associated with it. And consumerlab.com, if we're talking about evidence, George, we can talk about all the evidence that's presented on this website in a non-biased manner. And it'll show that if you take vitamin C, for some people, on a regular basis, it may reduce your reaction to colds. But there are other things that vitamin C does not do. And frankly, if you eat well and you eat foods that contain lots of vitamin C, there's no need to take the supplement. So to chastise and to malign people and personally attack people and their reputations and their credentials because you disagree with them does not forward a discussion. If you wish to call back and discuss the issue based on evidence instead of trying to malign people's reputations, then that's fair comment. But otherwise, this is an evidence-based program, and we deal with information as it is and look for evidence to either support or refute things. It's not a religion. It's not a matter of believing in something. It's a matter of a train of thought and an approach to determining what is accurate and what isn't. So, take that as it is, but that's the philosophy I tend to follow with regards to practice. But we've had this actually, thankfully, fairly rarely on the show where we have somebody who calls up and essentially maligns and criticizes someone, not on the basis of what they're saying, but on the basis of who they are and how they're not, and how they don't know what they're talking about. So that's my point of view on this, and I hope that people understand that. I'm fairly open with regards to information that's presented, but you have to have your facts in order and are willing to have a back and forth on this and not to immediately become defensive and say that somehow you don't know what you're talking about. I'm more than willing to listen to a person's point of view. I will then look up the evidence for that, and I'll give it back and have that person respond in kind. And that, to me, is the basis for trying to find out what is the best possible knowledge and information available on a topic, as opposed to believing in things. And nothing pleases me more to know if what we tend to have thought is correct now is shown not to be correct. Well, that about wraps it up for Sunday House Call. I will be away for the next 3 Sundays and back again, I believe it is the 26th of August. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You have been listening to Sunday House Call. Thanks to Sebastian for producing Sunday House Call. Have a great month.